Hello, Nasties. This is Elizabeth, and we hope you enjoy our episode today about period taboos. Just a quick note about the audio. For the first 25 to 30 minutes, my audio's a little wonky. I didn't check the settings before we hit record, and somehow I ended up recording from the internal mic on my computer instead of my external higher quality mic. It's fine. The content is great, as always, but the quality isn't quite where we want things to be. After about the 30-minute mark, things are perfect. So hopefully you can bear with us and listen to this amazing episode about period taboos across the world. Stay nasty.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello, and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice, and I'm here with
Elizabeth.
And we have several good news. First of all, we managed to get our first top 100 placement in the charts, in the Austrian iTunes charts, to be more exact. We were in the top 100s in all categories, and we were 16 in society and culture a week ago. So thank you very much to our Austrian Nasties for listening and downloading and telling your friends about us and rating and reviewing. So yeah, we really were very happy about this.
Yeah, it's amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also thank you and a shout out to a new Patreon member, Mika, and I'm going to butcher that name, Brdar, I don't know, Mika Brdar, I think. It's B-R-D-A-R, Mika, thank you. And I wanted to, a third thing I want to say is please go join our Facebook group. It's called Per Sisters, the She Who Persisted group. And people are starting to post there now. And I really like seeing that because I think one of the cool things about podcasts is that you can also kind of create a community around it. And I think particularly concerning the issues that we talk about, I think it would be just very cool if we just have the space where we can talk about the subjects that we also talk about in the episode with you. It's a closed group, so not everyone can join, but the thing you have to answer to get into the group is just a tagline, which should be easy for everyone who listens to the podcast. So
let's hope so.
It's basically just to prove that you're not a robot.
But if you're a robot who's also interested in women's issues, in feminist issues, then we welcome you.
In case you're like, feminist artificial intelligence is welcome too, but we assume that any feminist artificial intelligence robot will have listened to a podcast anyway, so they will also be able to answer the question. Yeah, and also Ine, our lovely listener a while back, suggested starting a She Who Persisted book club, and that's still kind of on the agenda, but we kind of thought that that would be, like, the group would also be a good place for that. So if you're interested in that, then go to the Per Sisters group and let's do it. Let's create a community.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm always looking for new books to read. So
yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, welcome back to a series on menstruation. This is episode 3 on the subject already.
In case you hadn't gotten enough about menstruation already.
Yeah, so in episode 1, we talked about period shame in our respective cultures. In episode 2, we talked about the money stuff, so tampon tax, period poverty, all of that jazz. And if you haven't listened to the other two episodes by now, go back and listen to those before you listen to that one. Today, as promised in the first episode already, we will delve deeper into the issue of menstrual taboos. And what we will do is take a bit of an, let's say, anthropological perspective.
Even though neither of us are anthropologists.
Well, I did study cultural and social anthropology at university. I just didn't finish it.
If you don't have a degree in it, you can't call yourself an anthropologist.
Oh, come on. I didn't say that I was an anthropologist. Yes. I just said I studied it.
Yes, I did not.
It's a fact. I did. Okay. So we will not be talking about the here and now so much, but we will talk about different times and cultural contexts and the types of menstrual taboos that existed in other contexts than ours.
Though there are some contemporary discussions of celebrations and cultural taboos around menstruation in different cultures.
Yeah, in different cultures. So we won't focus on our cultures. That's what I was trying to say. And again, of course, we will only kind of scratch the surface on some of these issues. And there will be a few instances where we'll say we won't go into detail because this will be a whole episode on its own. But as always, on our homepage, you will find, and our homepage is shewhopersisted.com, you will find a lot of resources to do further research yourself. You'll find a lot of links that you can read up on the subjects we talk about. Because when it comes to periods, there's just so much to talk about, which is also why we do a whole series on the subject.
Yes.
And another disclaimer, I think that's important when I or we talk about menstruation taboos all over the world in different cultural and religious contexts, we both do that as white women. I do it as a white woman from Austria, from a European country that was born in a majority Catholic country. You do it as
a white woman from the United States who grew up as a Catholic also, but in California. So if California Catholics are different.
It doesn't count.
They're not as serious about things as maybe their Austrian counterparts are. We do a lot of folk music and shit.
Yeah, I mean, in California, everything's different. Although I have to say that I grew up rather atheist. So, I mean, the culture around me is Catholic, but it's just not such a deal in my family. I know that we have listeners in all continents of the world, which is amazing, but that could also mean that your lived experience in a place that we are going to talk about, or as a member of a religion that we are going to talk about, is different. And if that's the case, and if you don't agree with anything we say in this episode, then please feel free to correct us and write us and tell us, because we like to learn.
Yes, and we try to be very intentional with our language to say people who menstruate, but sometimes we slip into just saying women. Please understand that our goal is to be as inclusive as possible and to really be talking about people who menstruate, regardless of whatever.
Yeah, so are you ready to talk about taboo, Liz?
I am. We have more than taboos in here, but let's do it.
Yeah. So Buckley and Gottlieb, two anthropologists who were actual anthropologists, as opposed to me, who just did a few courses at university and is not an actual anthropologist, as Liz quite rightfully pointed out. They wrote the book, or actually one of the books on the subject, and it's called Blood Magic. And Blood Magic is a cross-cultural study in which they found that taboos surrounding menstruation are basically universal. And they've been around in every culture, in every period, ha 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 ha, pun intended. But different cultural traditions and ideas about menstruation, quote, bespeak quite different, even opposite purposes and meanings. And at this point, I thought it was interesting to make a short excursion to the word taboo itself, because I think etymology is very interesting in the context of the subject of it's very interesting, period, but it's interesting in context of the subject of periods also. I'm sorry, I can't stop it with the puns. Okay, so because the term taboo, it originally comes from the Tongan tapu or the Fijian taboo, which means prohibited, disallowed or forbidden. And it's related to the Maori tapu on Hawaiian kapu and Mala Jazi Fadi. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. And the interesting thing about the word taboo is that it basically, on the one hand, the person that basically used the word in the English language first was the British explorer James Cook. And he used taboo for anything forbidden to be eaten or made use of. And he wrote, "Not one of them would sit down or eat a bit of anything. On expressing my surprise at this, they were all taboo, as they said, which word has a very comprehensive meaning, but in general signifies that a thing is forbidden." But then interestingly, this word has kind of a double meaning, because on the one hand, it means forbidden or cursed or unclean, inviolable. And on the other hand, it also means sacred and holy. And therefore, it's something that's protected by law or custom or restricted in some sense. And I found that very interesting because Gottlieb and Buckley point out that menstruation is often associated with the idea of uncleanliness. But at the same time, it's also scary, or it's scary precisely because it's something holy or sacred or very powerful, you know? So just like the term taboo itself etymologically implies both sacred and forbidden things, and both sacred and unclean things, menstruation does the same thing, right? So sometimes the consequences of patriarchal tabooizing, I don't even know if that's an English word, tabooizing interpretation of female reproductive functions in general and menstruation more precisely, are as ambivalent as the term taboo itself. One thing that happens in a lot of cultures is that menstruating people, women, are separated or isolated from the rest of society. And this might happen in the form of menstruation huts or tents. So this is one thing that will come up a lot in this episode, that people that menstruate are just isolated in some sense. And on the one hand, this happens as a result of the idea that they are unclean and must not defile either other members of society, particularly men, or even objects or crops with their uncleanliness. But on the other hand, this period of isolation often also means or meant that women, or people who menstruate, once a month had a fucking break from the hard work that they did, the male gaze that they were subjected to, male violence, and they can be amongst each other, you know? So it also had this other aspect of it can be something even empowering or freeing from societal constraints, in a sense, even if it's a result of a societal constraint, which is a bit a paradox at first glance, maybe, but you know, this is also how Gottlieb and Buckley describe it. And so in effect, some menstrual rights, even if they are based on very misogynistic ideas, can be experienced by women as protective and empowering, offering women or people who menstruate a space set apart from male gaze, from unwanted sexual, domestic pressures and demands. And an example provided by the anthropologist Wynne Maggie, or Maggie, I don't know, she describes the communal Bashali, which is a large menstrual house of women in the Kailashi Valley, which is in the northwest of Pakistan. And they understand that as their most holy place. And it's also respected by men, and they don't enter it. And it's kind of this all-female organizing center for also establishing and maintaining gender solidarity and power. So yes, it's a result of a patriarchal society, but then paradoxically, it created kind of safe spaces for women, in a sense. So according to one specific body of cultural evolutionary scholarship, the idea that menstrual blood marks the body as periodically sacred was initially established by female coalitions in their own interests, although later with the rise of cattle ownership and patriarchal power, these same beliefs and taboos were harnessed by religious patriarchs to intensify women's oppression.
Sure. I mean, if you think that a woman can't have access to living things, things that produce during their period, during their menstrual cycle, you know, when they're bleeding, then of course, you know, they can't own cattle because they can't have access to that cattle for parts of it and whatever.
Yeah.
Cultural theorist Judy Cron and others have developed what they call metaphoric theory. And it's like metaphor. Get it? Right? Okay. What Gron suggests in her book, Blood, Bread, and Roses, How Menstruation Created the World, is that menstruation is the central organizing concept in the creation of culture and forms the basis of humans' earliest rituals. An article entitled The Emergence of Metaformic Consciousness on her online journal Metaformia, a journal of menstruation and culture, which is excerpted from her book, states the following. Quote, menstrual seclusion rites in many parts of the world, as recorded over the last few centuries, typically include, among others, three basic prohibitions. The menstruating woman must not see light. She must not touch water, and she must not touch the earth. Since these same elements are differentiated in Genesis and other creation stories, I, and this is Judy Gron speaking here, began to see how menstrual rites might have, quote, created the world for ancient peoples, and to wonder whether the sleepers who awoke and saw a landscape, who named the elements, who separated the above from below and the darkness from light, water from earth, were informed by rites of seclusion that specified these very elements, singled them out for attention through regulations or taboos. So the idea is, you know, if we think about Genesis and someone kind of, you see the light and suddenly you're coming out of darkness into the light, this is the same thing for women who were placed in these menstrual huts, who were not allowed to see light, were not allowed to touch water, were not allowed to touch the earth. There is a kind of a metaphoric similarity between them. She continues that, quote, this unique cycle in correspondence with the cycles of an outside body, the waxing and waning of the moon, a body far beyond, as we learn later, the surface of the earth, taught humans to see from outside their animal bodies and to display that knowledge externally in physical culture. The menstrual mind became externalized because females were forced to teach its perspectives to members of the family who did not menstruate. And so women used their own bodies as metaphors for what was going on with the earth, or vice versa. Males, in learning the pattern, greatly extended it, rearranged it, demonstrated their comprehension one further step, and mirrored back to the females, an ongoing dance of minds between the genders. The consequences of the menstrual lunar correspondence is what has divided us for good and ill from the other animals. Unlike our simian relatives, unlike any other creature, humans use external measurement, the gift of menstruation. We have a lunar menstrual lever that enables us to move our sense back and forth between the subjective and the objective and to embody our ideas in external form. So essentially, she's explaining that what distinguishes us from animals and what has created the organizing aspects of our culture is the menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. The theory is used to examine how these restrictions on menstruation constructed our minds externally, not abstractly, but through using physical metaphors or metaforms that embodied a comparison to the menstrual-based idea. And looking at lunar calendars like that used in Judaism, we can see, which is based on the moon cycle, which is also then connected to menstruation. So we see that kind of metaphor or metaform. The question is, what came first? You know, did the cycle of the moon and the idea of it come before this kind of conversation about menstruation, or did menstruation kind of inform the creation of these lunar cycles? And metaformic theory suggests that they are so intertwined that you can't separate them. And you can absolutely read more about metaformic theory. I would totally recommend her book, but also the online open access journal, metaformia.org, which includes the work of other authors on metaformic theory related to menstrual topics. So the physical metaphors or metaforms become embodiments of menstruation. And in this way, metaformic theory has also been linked to post-queer theory. And though there are a lot of arguments in favor of post-queer theory or calling into question the usefulness of queer theory, Adam Isaiah Green suggests in his article, Gay But Not Queer, Towards a Post-Queer Study of Sexuality, that the subject in queer theory is an under-socialized queer subject with little connection to the empirical world and the socio-historical forces that shape sexual practice and identity. And he calls for reclaiming the specificity of gayness and identity, and it's very personal for him. But what we then see in Gregory Gaius's article, Soaked in Semen and Blood, Gay Men and the Queering of Metaformic Consciousness, is his connection between the blood of gay men's sexual encounters with menstrual blood. And this is where we see like the metaphors kind of coming, being extended. The blood then becomes this metaphor. And he states, if queer people can understand their bleeding as metaphoric, as related to menstrual cycles, new possibilities open up for creating further substitution towards social justice. So if we can build connections between menstruation and gay men's blood from sexual encounters, then there is an affinity between the two groups. He continues saying that today it's unthinkable that the patriarchal men's blood ritual of war could be replaced by anything, but the spread of metaphoric consciousness could create an opening for the honoring of gay men's blood rituals. What if the need for a blood ritual of war could be satisfied by the anal bleeding of gay men for pleasure? In this way, women's menstrual blood becomes productive rather than strictly abject or taboo. And then finally, sociological theorist Emile Durkheim argued that human religion in its entirety emerged originally in connection with menstruation. But this could be a whole episode on its own. I mean, Durkheim is like a whole thing. Yeah. And we're basically talking about period taboos today. But if we think about metaphoric theory and how it relates to, you know, other types of bleeding and could be productive in that way, and thinking about how there are metaphors for taking, you know, I don't want to say lesser populations, but subjected,
less privileged
populations, and using like that kind of connection to, you know, reframe the debate. I think it's really interesting.
So I listened to the podcast Stuff Mom Never Told You, which I really like, and they did an episode about period taboos. And there they said, and that's something I found interesting, that one of the origins of our current taboos surrounding menstruation is that women used to have much fewer periods than they have today, because they spent much more time being either pregnant, obviously, or lactating. Mm-hmm. So the women who did menstruate were the unmarried ones, so the prostitutes or the unattractive spinsters, aka feminists. So basically, menstruation was connected, on the one hand, to being an unattractive spinster, aka feminist, or being a loose woman, aka also feminist. However, there are a lot of ancient societies that regarded menstruation as sacred and powerful. And I wish Heather was here today, because I think she could talk about this a lot with much more expertise than we can.
But we did a lot of research, so you're going to listen to us instead. So according to the Cherokee, which, okay, let's just say we can't, the Cherokees are not all native first peoples. They are just one tribe among many. But according to the Cherokees, menstrual blood was a source of feminine strength and had the power to destroy enemies.
Which is amazing.
Know, it's fucking awesome. Cersei Dawn Sturm writes in her book, Blood Politics, Race, Culture, and Identity in the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, that like many tribal people around the world, Cherokee believed that women's menstrual blood is a powerful substance. It was not dirty or polluting, but it was a destructive force and a force of feminine strength. So she cites a story of a cannibal monster who could not be defeated by warriors, but was ultimately destroyed by seven menstruating virgins who drained his strength, which is fucking amazing.
Which reminds me so much of our episode on period shaming, where in the beginning I quoted Pliny the Elder in Natural History, where he said, where he talks about all of the horrible effects that women have when they menstruate, and their menstrual blood particularly has, that they can make bees die and all of
that. I mean, if a cannibal can only be defeated by seven menstruating virgins by draining its strength because it's so powerful, like what can't a menstruating virgin do?
Think about it.
But in addition to this symbolic power used in myth, she states that, quote, menstrual blood was also a force to be contended with in everyday Cherokee affairs. The destructive power of menstrual blood could be channeled against an enemy and was thus evoked in sorcery, at war, and in other rituals. Because it was considered to be so powerful, women were isolated from the tribe during their menstrual cycles. And sites that describe the isolation of women are very clear in this point. Websites are very clear when they say that this is done because of our great respect for women and the creative powers that they possess. A menstruating woman's presence anywhere in the vicinity of a ritual or ceremony could render it ineffective or could cause some other problem. A woman's menstrual cycle is evidence of her creative powers. It's a time when she should be careful because of the strong energies she exudes. So it's not, I mean, in some ways, this kind of goes back to our conversation about women as patients, where like they weren't doing studies on women because they would screw up the results because women's bodies were so, quote, unpredictable. Yeah. But also, it's an acknowledgement that there is a power that comes with menstruation. And as such, you know, it can't, you know, it has to be dealt with and used carefully because it is so powerful.
Yeah. And it goes back to what I said about taboo itself. You know, it's on the one hand, something very powerful and sacred. And on the other hand, it's something kind of repudiated. You know, it's both things at the same time. It's elevated to like sacredness, and then on the other hand, it's also very, very disrespected and kind of considered dirty.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Menstrual blood is also often viewed as especially dangerous to men's power. Which let's talk about this, ladies. why are men so afraid of menstruation? Partially because we don't talk about it, but also maybe because they're afraid it's going to drain them of their precious manly power.
Maybe.
But in some African societies, and again, Africa is not a country. It is not homogeneous. It is made up of a lot of different areas and peoples. But in some African societies, menstrual blood is used in the most powerful magic charms in order to both purify and destroy. And again, we're not just lumping them all together. But in the book Iron Gender and Power, Rituals of Transformation in African Societies, researcher Eugenia W. Herbert describes the menstrual taboos among the Asante, an ethnic group in modern Ghana. And she states that their menstrual taboos extend to anything concerned with God's ancestors and senior chiefs, and even to some fetishes and medicines. If a menstruating woman entered a stool room, and I would assume that's a room with stools in it where they perform things, her state would drive away the spirits of the ancestors. But she's also forbidden to touch or handle any tools used to make things or change one sort of thing into another. So anything that's transformative. And Herbert argues that this is a, quote, clear statement of the incompatibility of menstruation as failed conception with activities that are construed as transformative or procreative. So if you're menstruating because menstruation is a failed attempt at procreation, it has to be separated from all forms of creation and transformation. She points out that the menstrual huts were located on the margins of the village and the bush, in burial places of babies, prepubescent children, witches, criminals, and the victims of inauspicious deaths. Which is interesting because it also exists in a sort of liminal space or a transitional space. But if the Asante beliefs are any indication, even though menstruation suggests the fertility of a woman, it is also symbolic of her failure to be pregnant and the inability to have created life.
So one thing that I find particularly interesting is that she writes that the ambivalent meaning of menstruation here is kind of a metaphor for the ambivalence of the patriarchal idea of woman itself. And this is also something that we will come across later on. And that's also something that we come across in our culture, is that women as a whole are devalued because they menstruate, or that the cultural ideas about menstruation kind of become the cultural ideas we have about women.
Yeah, it's. I think I've mentioned this before. When I started to have kind of perimenopausal symptoms, I started to research, you know, what early menopause is all about and whatever. And I found that in a lot of medical literature, they refer to the time when a woman is menstruating to premenopausal.
Yeah.
So like everything is related to a woman's ability to, like, the moment when a woman stops being useful, to, like, and when she can't procreate anymore. Like you're pre-menstrual, you know, before you have a period, then you're premenopausal, and then you're menopausal, and then, you know, whatever. Then it's
over.
And
then you're basically useless.
Exactly.
Oh, God, yeah.
So, yeah. So let's get back to some mythology. So Mayan mythology explains that the origins of menstruation are a punishment for violating the social rules governing a marital alliance. So the origin of menstruation was said to be a punishment for the moon goddess. And this may sound familiar to those of you familiar with the book of Genesis and the story of Adam and Eve, who, after eating from the tree of knowledge, was punished, quote, to woman, he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain, you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be contrary to your husband, but he shall rule over you.
Oh, nice. That's cool.
Yeah, right?
I'm cool with that. That's fine.
Anyway, according to Mayan legend, if the menstruating woman was to be made angry, her menstrual blood would turn into snakes and insects before the moon goddess was reborn from it. Because of this legend, the people of some communities would exile their wives and daughters while they were menstruating to avoid an event such as this, which, I mean, if I thought that my wife's like or daughter's menstrual blood was going to turn into snakes and insects, I would probably insist on that as well.
Yeah. Interestingly, we also have like this image of snakes here, which is also happening in the story of Eve and Adam.
Yeah.
That's also interesting, I think.
Yeah. So the bigger issue, though, is that the cultural idea that menstruating women are essentially impure or bad, and that her body is a representation of this, and as such, she's punished by God, or her community is concerned that she will be punished by God, and that they, by extension, will be punished, and therefore she has to be separated from the community to protect it. Mm-hmm. Where women's blood is considered sacred, the belief is that she should be ritually set apart. So like, no matter what, women should be ritually set apart, either because they're too powerful or because they're unclean.
Yeah. Which again is like this ambivalent construction of menstruation, both unclean and too powerful.
Exactly. So when sacred blood comes into contact with profane things, then it becomes experienced as either ritually dangerous or ritually unclean. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So women are fucked either way.
Yeah. Women are fucked up and they are fucked and they fuck things up because they menstruate. So
yes,
that's the summary of this whole episode. Actually, you can stop listening now.
Yeah. You don't even have to listen to any more of it.
You
that's it.
Just don't bother because that's it. No, please stay, because now we're getting into, modern day religion. Let's put it that way. Now we talked about Mayan things. That's a long time ago. Now we talk about, we'll talk about now the three monotheistic religions, the big ones, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, Judaism, as you know, is kind of the first one of those, historically, the one that came about first. And Judaism in its orthodox form kind of seems to be the most exclusionary to women who menstruate, because in Judaism, menstruating women are excluded ritually, and this ritual is called nidah. And nida applies to women while menstruating and for about a week thereafter until she immerses herself in a ritual bath called a mikvah, which is basically intended only for married women. And this is also something that will come up later again. So we already talked about the practice of isolating women when they menstruate. This is something that happened over time, over cultures. It's something that comes up over and over again, but also something that comes up over and over again is the idea of ritual cleansing that needs to happen after this period of isolation so that the woman can enter or re-enter society.
Not as though women can't clean themselves and it has to, you know, that, but like the society has to create some sort of ritual in order to fully cleanse her.
Yeah. Yeah. So the term nidah applies to the woman herself. So she's considered a nidah, which means impure due to her natural menstrual cycle, basically. But the nidah is also the phase of exclusion. And the phase begins at the first drop of menstrual blood, and it continues for about a week after menstruation is over. And at the end of that week, she undergoes this elaborate ritual bath, the mikvah or mikveh. And upon completing this bath, she has to approach the temple with a sacrifice in hand, which is usually a pair of doves. Like, this is the original Orthodox idea. And she hopes that the rabbi accepts her as clean once more. And this is actually laid out in the 15th chapter of Leviticus.
Leviticus is, I mean, like, as a Catholic, we believe both the Old and New Testament. But Leviticus is basically the part that lays out all of the laws. And so much of it is, like, way over the top.
Surprisingly. How could that happen?
I know.
I'm so shocked that the Bible has over-the-top rules, especially when it comes to women. So 15th chapter of Leviticus, I quote, "Whenever a woman has her menstrual period, she will be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. Anyone who touches her during that time will be unclean until evening. Anything on which the woman lies or sits during the time of a period will be unclean."
I mean, if she doesn't have pads.
I was just going to say, listen, period poverty is a problem. Apparently, it was a problem back then, too. "If a man has sexual intercourse with her and her blood touches him, her menstrual impurity will be transmitted to him. He will remain unclean for 7 days, and any bed on which he lies will be unclean. When the woman's bleeding stops, she must count off 7 days. Then she will be ceremonially clean. On the 8th day, she must bring 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons and present them to the priest at the entrance of the tabernacle." Yeah, unquote.
So here's the deal. Like, if I was the husband and I knew that I was already going to be unclean for touching her period blood, like,
I give a fuck.
It's already happened. Let's move on.
What I find interesting is that they come up with this idea of 7 days. Like, the number of 7 comes up a lot. And then why is it, like, that anyone who touches her is unclean until evening? Like, why?
I'm not Jewish.
Yeah.
Caveat. But 7 is, it's a biblical number. On the 7th day he rested is in Genesis with the creation of the world. So it establishes a cycle.
Yeah.
So 7 days is typically like a cycle of a week or, you know, a period of time. And then the evening, that is part of, and again, I'm not Jewish, so, but my understanding is part of the Jewish religion is that it goes from sundown to sundown. And so by the time sundown happens, that is the start of a new day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, makes sense, I guess, kind of. Okay, so... So kind of the gist of it is that during this time, even a married couple must avoid sexual intercourse and any form of physical intimacy, actually, because if the man touches her, he will be unclean until evening. And then Orthodox Judaism forbids women and men from even touching or passing things to each other during this period. And of course, and I think that's important to understand here, is that this is like Orthodox Judaism. I mean, many Jewish people in other branches of the religion nowadays don't do Judaism that way.
They just don't do Judaism.
This is true for many things that we'll talk about today, especially for the religions that are still around. Of course, we talk about like the most extreme, like Orthodox branches of it.
Or the ones that we have evidence, you know, the religions that are still around, the most extreme versions, but also, you know, for cultures where I want to say foreign, but put that in quotations, like ones that are not Western, that we are getting the information based on anthropologists who have been part of those cultures and who have done research, field research, that those are what they have studied. And so, you know, there may be other communities that have very different beliefs.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people who are religious are not conservative at the same time. And of course, the extent to which these rules that we talk about are observed in modern Judaism or modern Islam too, or modern Christianity, of course, that varies depending on the degree of the conservative and orthodoxy of the people that we talk about. Yeah. And then there's also one thing that I found interesting, and I can't pronounce it. It's called tzniut, which is Hebrew for modesty. Tzniut? Tzniut? I don't know.
Why are you asking me?
I don't know, because maybe you know. So many Orthodox Jews and some conservative Jewish people also, they follow the custom of keeping the times of Nidah, so the menstruation, secret from the general public. And that's also interesting, especially also in connection to what we talked about in the first episode of menstruation, on the episode about period positivity and period shame. We talked a lot about the idea of leakage panic and how in our culture too, menstruation is something that has to be hidden because it's considered shameful.
Sure.
Yeah, and then apparently there have also been nida huts in some places. So places where women were isolated during the times of menstruation. And then what's also interesting is that there's a type of cloth that's called bedika, or checking cloth. And it's a clean piece of white cloth that's used in a process of purifying a nida, a menstruating woman. And I'm quoting Wikipedia here. So, quote, it is used by observant Jewish women to determine whether they have finished menstruation. The cloth is inserted into the vagina, and if no blood is found, the woman may start counting the 7 blood-free days. On each of these days, she performs this examination in the morning and in the late afternoon before sunset. If no blood is found, she may go to the mikveh, which is the ritual bath, on the 8th evening after nightfall, and then engage in intercourse with her husband. Such cloths are about 2 by 4 inches and are available at local Judaica stores, the local mikveh stores in Orthodox neighborhoods in Israel, or maybe cut from clean all-white soft cotton or linen fabric. This practice is also occasionally used by Jewish men to check if he has gotten blood on himself from his wife after intercourse to determine whether she menstruated during intercourse, unquote.
Is she like tricking him, or is this at the beginning?
What do you mean?
Well, like, so if she is menstruating, then she would have been, I mean, if they are that part of this practice, then she would have been doing, like, she would have been doing nida at this point and whatever. So is this like, but done by Jewish men, like,
that's
to
a
check
good question.
Every time they have intercourse to determine if, like, she has started her period and therefore he's gotten blood, her menstrual blood on him, and, like, this starts the beginning of nida, or?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea. But again, obviously, this refers to very traditional and Orthodox interpretations of the religion. I know Jewish people who I'm pretty sure don't do these things, so.
Yeah, sure. So let me talk a little bit about what happens in Islam. And let me preface this by saying that I am not a scholar of Islam and that this information is available online and through research that we've done.
Which is like true for everything we talk about here, because we're not scholars of Judaism either.
Yeah. So Islam basically has a version of Judaic nida that is less severe. During her period, a woman is considered unclean, but the only restrictions that she has are that she not have sex, not touch a Quran, and not enter a mosque for a full week. So as in Judaism, she has to undergo a ritual bath before being deemed clean again. That being said, respect for women on their period is valued. In the Quran, it states, quote, and they ask you about menstruation. Say it is harm, so keep away from women during menstruation. And do not approach them until they become pure. And when they have purified themselves, then come to them from where Allah has ordained for you. Indeed, Allah loves those who are constantly repentant and loves those who purify themselves. Your women are your tilth, so come to your tilth as you wish and put forth for yourself. And fear Allah and know that you will meet him and give good tidings to the believers. Great. So Islam doesn't consider menstruating women to possess any kind of contagious uncleanliness. And this is from, I was reading several articles about the Islamic rituals and taboos. So Azim from 1995 specifies that Islam does not consider menstruating women to possess contagious uncleanliness. An engineer, that is their last name, states that the Islamic law treats menstruation as impure for religious functions only. So one of the things is that she may not enter a shrine or a mosque. And in fact, she may not pray or fast during Ramadan while she is menstruating. She may not touch a Quranic codex or even recite its contents. During menses, pilgrimages are allowed. However, like walking around the Kaaba, a building at the center of Islam's most important mosque in Mecca, is prohibited and is to be performed during other times. So if she does the pilgrimage but is on her period, then she has to wait to actually approach the Kaaba once the period is over and she's been cleansed. And women are advised to not enter the praying place of a mosque without any important purpose, but are encouraged to be present at Muslim gatherings and festivals. So she's also not allowed to have sexual intercourse for a full 7 days, beginning when the bleeding starts. So obviously less strict than the Orthodox Jewish Nida. She's exempted from rituals such as daily prayers and fasting, although she's not given an option of performing these rituals, even if she wants to. In addition, a woman must complete a ritual washing before she becomes clean. Following this washing, she's able to perform prayers, fasting, and allowed to enter a mosque. Following a lengthy discussion of Islamic purity laws, scholar with the last name Magan, from her piece from 1999, concludes that the, quote, problem with menstruating women reflected in the restrictions placed upon certain of their activities is confined to the ritually threatening properties of their menstrual blood per se. So if we compare this to the Cherokee prohibitions, it seems to be related to the idea that their menstrual blood is potentially dangerous or problematic for religious rituals. But we also see that with the ritual washing, the prohibition placed on sexual intercourse, that menstruation is also a period of uncleanliness. So problems for religious rituals and an issue of uncleanliness. The prohibition on sex, however, may also be related to the focus on sex as a procreative act. It makes no sense to have sex during one's menstrual cycle if the only purpose of sex is procreation. We see that over and over again. When I did my kind of natural family planning, getting married in the Catholic Church, they make you kind of chart out your temperature and figure out what days you are most fertile. And then from there, you can also figure out the days that you're not fertile, which obviously is your period. And so the goal of it is to not have to use contraception and just use your own body's like abilities to like not be fertile to determine when to have sex and when not to have sex. Like, so if you want to have a baby, you should be able to use it. And if you don't want a baby, you should be able to use it. But like, I mean, it's really more effective if you want to have a baby, but you can determine the times when your body's not fertile, which during menstruation, totally not fertile. For the most part.
Like Christian, at least the Catholic idea of like sexual morals is that you should have sex basically only for the purpose of procreation. Like,
I mean, I think that I would say that many, many religions are like that. Yeah. But Christianity, as a Catholic myself and having gone through all of these fucking classes, that is the purpose of procreation. Yeah.
Which is just
sex, procreation.
I mean, of course, this is a question of powerful people trying to control people's sexuality. But it's, of course, also fucking stupid because it's a complete misunderstanding of how human sexuality works, which is just so much more than procreation. Or actually, there's two different things. There's sexuality and then there's procreation. And they sometimes go together, but they don't necessarily have to.
Yeah, no, agreed. So speaking of Christianity, some church fathers defended, and by I say church fathers, like early on in the Christian church when the church was being formed, defended the exclusion of women from ministry based on the notion of uncleanliness. Others held that purity laws should be discarded as part of the old covenant and that with the New Testament, with Christianity, we had a new covenant. One of the things that I always thought was really interesting about both the Old Testament and the New Testament is that, you know, Moses goes out and like he has his brother Aaron to help him, you know, spread the message of the Old Testament and all of that. But he also, and the Ten Commandments, but he also had a sister, Miriam, who was also very influential and very necessary to his, I can't say ministry, but his work. And we always like Forget about Miriam.
I've never even heard of her. I can't think of, like, yeah. I've never heard of her.
Yeah, Miriam.
Yeah.
She was actually a very important part of, combined with Moses and Aaron, yeah. You know, spreading the Ten Commandments and Judaism.
I mean, we could do an episode about forgotten women in the Bible. I think that would be interesting.
I'd be fine with that. We could talk about that. Anyway, so some Christian denominations, including many authorities in the Eastern Orthodox Church and some parts of the Oriental Orthodox Church, known as the Russian or Ukrainian, Greek, Indian Orthodox churches, advise women not to receive communion during their menstrual period. But there's actually no actual prohibition in the New Testament, which is the foundation of Christianity. Conservative traditionalist members of the Orthodox Church observe the ancient practice of abstaining from Holy Communion during menstruation. It's a fairly common practice throughout Greece and Russia and other historically Orthodox countries. However, most non-Orthodox countries, especially in Europe and North America, in most of these places, women do not practice this. In fact, many Orthodox Christian women are unaware of the practice of abstaining from communion during menstruation and view it as like an old wives' tale. Apparently, though, Russian Orthodox Christians believe in menstrual taboos, and menstruating women must live secluded in a tiny hut during this time. They cannot attend church services or have any contact with men. They cannot touch raw or fresh food because, you know, it might cause the food to spoil, Pliny the Elder.
That happens so quickly.
And menstruating women are also thought to offend and repel fish and game. The air surrounding menstruating women is believed to be especially polluting to young hunters.
What?
If a hunter gets close enough to a woman to touch, then all animals will be able to see him and he won't be able to hunt them. And a menstruating woman's gaze is even thought to affect the weather negatively.
So the air around her is like poisonous.
Polluted.
That's ridiculous. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, nice. Okay.
So there you go. Russian Orthodox. And I am not Russian Orthodox, so I cannot speak to the validity of this. This is what came up
in
my research.
As we said, time and time again. So, and then Buddhism seems to be, so we've got the three big monotheistic religions now. We'll talk about other world religions now that are not monotheistic religions. So that's kind of a different tradition now. Buddhism seems to be most relaxed about menstruation because they view menstruation as, quote, a natural physical excretion that women have to go through on a monthly basis, nothing more or less. So
holy shit.
What? Like, so menstrual blood is not specifically impure or more impure than other bodily functions. But that's the point, because in Buddhism, all bodily secretions are disgusting and impure. It's just
got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Everyone is filthy.
It's just that menstruation is not more filthy than anything like other bodily functions.
Sure.
So, and then there's also this idea that a woman loses a bit of her life force, her chi, during that period. And then there's the idea that ghosts eat blood, which renders women more vulnerable to spiritual impurities, seeing as how she'd be surrounded by blood-eating ghosts during that time. So, but most Buddhism's prohibitions against menstruation, such as forbidding women from entering temples during the period, are thought to be kind of customs that I inherited from Hinduism. So, yeah. And in Japanese Buddhism, there's kind of a special variety of it. Menstruating women are also banned from attending temples. But in Buddhism, there's not much more to say about menstruation other than our bodies are just disgusting vessels that we need to exist on this planet. But yeah, it's just, our body functions are themselves disgusting, and there's nothing more impure about menstruation. It's just like part of this prison of physical existence. And then in Hinduism, according to Hindu legend, menstruation began after Lord Indra severed the head of, okay, Vishwarupacharya?
That's what I would say.
Ostensibly out of anger because he found it impossible to pronounce his name. Which, I get it. Okay. And as in other major religions, menstruation in Hinduism is deemed as a sign of not just physical, but also spiritual impurity. In Hinduism, traditionally, menstruating women are considered ritually impure and they have to follow a number of rules. They are, for example, not allowed to enter the kitchen, enter temples. They are not allowed to wear flowers, to have sex, or to touch other males or females, so to touch other people, basically. Mm-hmm. The women themselves are seen as impure and polluted, and they're often isolated as untouchables, unable to return to the family and community for the length of the period. So again, this idea of they need to be excluded from society because they're impure and cannot be touched and cannot be trusted, and they're basically dangerous forces during the time of the period. In Orthodox Brahmin Hindu families, menstruating women are often asked to stay away from domestic activities for a period of 4 days. Again, also physical intimacy is prohibited. And in very conservative households, women have separate rooms to stay in. They also have separate plates and cutlery. And they're not allowed to enter the kitchen or any sacred section of the house. Women who do crafts or arts or music or whatever, they're supposed to not touch the tools for these 3 days. And on a third day, the woman takes a ritual bath, again, the ritual bathing that we also saw in Judaism. And then she's considered cleansed and is allowed to resume her normal routine. And this is described as a spiritual practice, but it's usually only found in those Brahmin families. Most other subcultures of Hinduism, they require the woman to carry on as normal.
I think what strikes me is that similarity between so many of these taboos and ritual practices, that the isolation, I mean, this goes back to the metaphoric tradition that there's isolation, they're not allowed to touch things. The women who do crafts not being able to touch their tools is very similar to that Cherokee prohibition of touching anything that has to do with rituals. Again, you know, in the Cherokee belief, it's not because she's unclean per se, but because her power can disrupt them. In this case, it is because there's an impurity. But I, you know, the similarity, it's just like fairy tales. You know, we have all of these fairy tales that are so similar, and they are cross-cultural, and they're even between cultures that have never had any contact with one another. The fact that these taboos and these rituals emerge fully independent of one another is very interesting.
It's so fascinating. This is also something that I was thinking when I did the research. It's like the same tropes just come up over and over again. The isolation, the ritual bathing, the not being able to touch things. Yeah, everything that you just said, it's just so fascinating that this is something that happens through cultures and societies and times and space, basically. So Hindus in Nepal, they traditionally, the women, Hindu women in Nepal traditionally are also kept isolated during menstruation. They're not allowed in the household for also a period of 3 nights. So the interesting thing here in the Hindu traditions is that we have the number of three coming up over and over again. In the Judaistic tradition, we have the number of seven. So, this practice was actually banned by the Nepalese Supreme Court in 2005, but it's still actually happening. And then there's a social tradition called, Chaupadi, and it's associated with a menstrual taboo in the western part of Nepal, and this tradition prohibits Hindu women and girls from participating in normal family activities while menstruating because they are considered impure. And in some parts of western Nepal also, this custom of Chaupadi requires menstruating girls and women to sleep in a hut called Chaugoth, which is some distance away from the family home. So again, we have the exclusions aspect and the menstruating hut thing mm-hmm. going on. And then in Bali, so of course Hinduism is like a huge religion and there are very, very different regional varieties of it. So I just looked at some of those. And in Bali, a woman is not allowed to enter the kitchen or perform her usual duties when she's menstruating. And she's also not allowed to have sex with her husband. Again, this is also something that we heard so many times mm-hmm. today. She has to sleep apart from the family and she has to keep her clothes that she wears or wore while menstruating away from any clothes that she wears when she goes to the temple. So if you're a woman in Bali, in like a traditional context, you cannot wear clothes to the temple that you menstruated in. And of course, one of the most important regulations is that women are not allowed to attend the temple while menstruating. And in Sumba, which is also like Bali in Indonesia, women keep the cycle secret also, which is not something that is very different in our time mm-hmm. and place, right? But there's this cultural idea around it that because of this, women are considered deceitful. And then, and there's this idea that because of their secrecy, they will always have control over the men, right?
Well, that's fair.
Yeah. So women are supposed to avoid intercourse while menstruating, and it's believed that sexually, and that's a huge problem. So it's believed that sexually transmitted diseases are the result of women deceiving men and having intercourse while they're menstruating. And gonorrhea actually translates the Sumba version of like the Sumba, the word in, I think, Indonesian, translates as disease you get from women. And when a man would get this disease, so the idea is that the only way he can rid himself of it and of the disease and the painful source that it creates is to pass it on to a woman. And the reasoning behind it is that a woman's body can absorb this infection and purge it during her menstrual cycle.
Oh, Jesus.
And yeah. And that's hugely problematic. And it's something that also comes up in other contexts. So Sumba is not the only place where this happens. The idea that menstruation can either be used for contraception or that it has these magical powers that can heal STDs or STIs is something that comes up over and over again also. And in Sumba, this actually led to a huge societal problem of men intentionally infecting women with diseases.
I mean, vaginas are magical, but... Mm. I will say this is
yeah.
I mean, okay, sure. Yeah. I just there are no words. There are no words.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's also important to see that you know, taboos and just very patriarchal and bigoted ideas about menstruation and about women's bodies lead to huge societal problems and to basically sometimes life-threatening situations for women.
Sure.
In all societies where they exist, basically. And this is a very extreme example.
Well, I mean, the other problem is, you know, these men have gonorrhea and they think they're curing their gonorrhea by having sex with a woman, but really they're just passing it on and they're never getting cured either. Unless they at some point take antibiotics for it. It's totally curable with antibiotics. I mean,
so, and then in India, Hindus usually view menstruation as something very positive, especially the first menstruation of a girl. And in South India, girls often, so during the first menstrual period, they're given presents, there are celebrations to mark the occasion. So, there are very, very different approaches to menstruation in Hinduism because there are so different variants of it.
So then it becomes like a bat mitzvah. Then it's like, oh, you know, you've become a woman.
And then there's the Jabua district. And in areas around that, the belief is that menstruation is a disease and not a normal biological process. And therefore, women who are menstruating are not allowed to sleep on beds, enter kitchens, touch male members of their family or eat spicy foods. And then in a 2014 study conducted in India, The researchers found that as many as 42% of women who participated in the study didn't know about sanitary pads or from where in their anatomy the menstruation actually originated. And most of them were very scared and worried about the first menstruation that they have. So again, in Hinduism, like, there's a whole variety of ideas about menstruation, starting from it's something to be valued and celebrated, to it's disgusting and a disease and not normal, to it's something that has magical powers and heals STDs. So a whole variety of ideas.
That is, yeah. I mean, you were complaining about mm-hmm. sex education and all of that in Austria, but I will say one positive thing about India is that they were going to be taxing sanitary pads at 12%, and now they have removed the tax on feminine hygiene.
Better
projects.
Than what we have in Austria, because they're still taxed with 20%, which is ridiculous. We talked about this last time. So apart from the five big world religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, and Buddhism, we can also talk about the small and less influential religions and what they think about menstruation.
Yeah. So in Shaktiism, which is a major tradition in Hinduism, so it's part of Hinduism, basically like a branch of it, where the metaphysical reality is considered mm-hmm. feminine and Parvati or goddess is supreme. It includes a variety of goddesses, all considered aspects of the same supreme goddess. So if you think of the same way that Catholicism talks about like the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit being and all being God. In this sense, we have a goddess and she has different aspects. So Shaktiism has several different sub-traditions, ranging from those focused on gracious Gauri to fierce Kali. And some Shakti sub-traditions associate their goddess with Shiva or Brahma or Vishnu. So there are, you know, there's a goddess, but a lot of different aspects of Shaktiism like focus on different aspects of that goddess. But since it's a religion focused on goddesses, it's unsurprising that they would have a tradition and various traditions associated with menstruation. So in her 1994 article, Women, Earth, and the Goddess, a Shakta Hindu Interpretation of Embodied Religion, Kartikeya Pratel argues that female embodied experience is central to the religious practice and beliefs in this religious tradition. And her article explains how the divine is represented, quote, as a female body of which women, earth, and goddess are but different manifestations. Further, she explains an embodied religion as that in which the presence of the female body of women, earth, and the goddess is celebrated rather than denied. She goes on to explain how, quote, a woman's nature is defined in terms of the essential quality of being a woman, that is, menstruation or ritu. And the term ritu, which signifies menstruation, also signifies the cyclical changes of the seasons, as well as the orderliness of the cosmos. So thus, it's believed that the menstrual cycle in the female body corresponds to and represents the cyclical changes of the seasons and the orderliness of the universe. So a woman's ritu dharma is then said not only to interrelate and integrate the concept of woman, female, and feminine, but also interrelate humans to their environment and to sociocultural reality in which their rites and rituals attain fruition. So in a lot of ways, this kind of relates back to the metaphoric theory of, culture. So Patel points to field work that was done by Frederick Appel Marglin and Purna Chandra Mishra on the menstruation festival or Raja Parba of the goddess in the Indian state of Orissa. Basically, this is a festival of menstruation of the goddess who is known as Harchandi Pritib Thakurant Basudha and Draupat. And the term Raja Parva basically means that the festival is of the menses of the goddess. So it takes place between June 14th and 18th, and the earth is basically said to be menstruating. It's believed that for humans to plow or dig the earth during the menstrual period violates her and makes her unhappy. So instead, they have a festival. So the main participants in this festival are women and men from the agricultural community, but members of various social areas also take part in the festival. And each day of the festival has different meanings and different ceremonies. I'm not going to go into all of them, but I will say that the one goddess celebrated in the festival is known by four different forms. Each manifestation is thought to symbolize a different aspect of the great goddess. So, for instance, the goddess Har Chandi is Mother Earth, who is said to be menstruating during this festival. On the other hand, the goddess Draupadi is remembered and worshipped as the heroine of one of their epic stories. However, for the participants, different manifestations of the goddess are not always distinguishable. And Har Chandi is frequently identified as Draupadi, and leading devotees of both forms of the goddess speak about them kind of interchangeably. Women and men believe that both Draupadi, the goddess incarnate as the epic heroine of their epic stories, and Har Chandi, the goddess incarnate of Earth, have menstruation in common. And moreover, women see themselves identifying with the goddess and consider themselves as part of the goddess because they also menstruate just like the goddess. They believe that they are representatives of the goddess and that their menstruation is given to them from the goddess. So during this period, the annual menstruation course of the goddess is worshipped in the temple. The temple stays closed for 3 days, then reopens to receive pilgrims and worshipers. It's one of the most important pilgrimage sites in the world. This is the Kamakhatia Temple. And it attracts millions of visitors each year, particularly for the Ambubachi Mela Festival, which draws upwards of 100,000 pilgrims per day for the 4-day festival. So here's one that is maybe a little more positive.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge difference between looking at regarding your menstruation as as the thing that makes you similar to the goddess than regarding it as filthy and impure. So it's a very different type of tradition.
I mean, they also, you know, they're not plowing the fields because they think it would make the goddess angry because she's menstruating. Yeah. So like, don't make anyone angry while they're menstruating. This is something that we've seen before. Yeah. It turns her into snakes and beetles. But at the same time, you know, there is a positive connotation, even though there's this, it's not impurity per se. It's that like, we don't want to upset the goddess. So we're going to, you know, venerate her, and all women can be a part of that.
And there's still, I mean, a difference between, you know, ideas that maybe lead to respecting women more because menstruation is seen as something powerful. And then on the other hand, ideas that lead to women being disrespected because they menstruate. And I think in that case, it's more like the first one.
Yes. Yes.
That wasn't an English sentence, but you know what I mean.
I get it. I get it.
So I just wanted to say for our listeners, if you're interested in goddess, goddesses and, you know, cults and not cults, but religious traditions surrounding goddesses and goddesses' beliefs, then you should check out our very first episode where we talked about spring goddesses and the pagan origins of Easter. And you should listen to our episode 23, which was about summer solstice with Heather Moser, and who was one of our hosts before our relaunch. So I think in those two episodes we talked a lot about goddesses.
Yeah.
And that might also interest you. Yeah.
And then the last one that I'll talk about is Shinto. So this is a Japanese national religion. Menstruating women are not only seen as impure during their cycle, but they are permanently impure merely due to the fact that they menstruate.
Which is also something that we heard often today.
Yeah. There's the idea the kami, the spirits they worshipped, would not grant wishes if you had traces of blood, dirt, or death on you. And obviously menstruation is like blood and death. So, okay. Women who were menstruating were not allowed to visit any of the kami shrines for the duration of their menstrual period. Even today, women are not allowed and this is like an older tradition, but even today, women are not allowed to enter Shinto shrines and temples during menstruation. And in some instances, women are completely banned from climbing the tops of sacred mountains due to their impurity. Plus, they're just weaker, so no.
Yeah, they can't do it anyway.
Yeah, sarcasm. furthermore, the tradition is kept somewhat alive in the belief that the shedding of the endometrial lining is a kind of death, which is not an uncommon belief. This idea that it is fully non-procreative, that it represents an aborted attempt at potentially having a child, that it is representative of death, is something that we've seen over and over again in a lot of these taboos.
Yeah, one religious tradition that is sometimes, or very often actually, quoted as kind of a positive example for how it treats menstruation and menstruating women is Sikhism. In Sikhism, women are basically given equal status to men, and they are regarded as pure as men. And the Sikh gurus, they teach that one cannot be pure simply by washing their body, but it's all about purity of mind. So the real pureness is not about how clean your body is, but about how clean your mind is. And Guru Nanak, which is kind of the founder of Sikhism, he condemned the practice of treating women as impure while menstruating, because in Sikhism, the menstrual cycle is not considered impure, it's not considered uncleanly, and the women who menstruate are also not considered impure and uncleanly. And Sikhism says, yes, menstruation has a physical and physiological effect on women, but she's allowed to pray, she's allowed to do all of the religious shebang she wants to do. The guru makes it very clear, the guru by the name Guru Nanak, makes it very clear that the menstrual cycle is a, quote, God-given process. And the blood of the woman is required for the creation of any human being. And the requirement of the mother's blood is thus fundamental for life. And the menstrual cycle is an essential and God-given biological process. And because of that, there are no restrictions placed on a woman during her menstruation. In the feminine principle, in the Sikh vision of the transcendent, this is again a name that I'm going to butcher. Nikki Guninder Kar Singh writes, quote, "The denigration of the female body expressed in many cultural and religious taboos surrounding menstruation and childbirth is absent in the Sikh worldview. Guru Nanak openly chides those who attribute pollution to women because of menstruation." So it seems like of all of the patriarchal religions, Sikhism is the most friendly towards menstruation. But there are, of course, other examples of religions appreciating menstruation. You already heard Liz talk about Shaktism. I think what's important, and as stated in like the introduction to this episode, menstruation usually has been regarded as awe-inspiring, both awful and awesome. And in most cultures, at most times, menstruation has been a very ambivalent thing, both terrifying and magical. And there are some traditions that are more on the awesome side of things. There are, you know, some traditions that are more on the awful side of interpreting menstruation. But usually we must not forget that both interpretations are part of the same patriarchal coin. The Yurok in North America, for example, they practice menstrual seclusion. And the Yurok women used a small hut near the main house. The Yurok, of course, are a native tribe in North America. However, as Gottlieb, one of the authors of Blood Magic that I also already quoted, a book that I already quoted earlier today, she states, quote, "Yurok, a native tribe from the northwest coast of the United States, stratified by class, had a group of aristocratic women who saw their periods as a time for purifying themselves. And as many women living in close proximity do, this group had their periods at the same time each month. And quote, they were on a shared menstrual cycle and did a series of rituals during the cycle that they say was a period of the most heightened spiritual experience, unquote. So on the one hand, we have this practice of exclusion from society. But then on the other hand, those women experienced that as a very positive thing. Again, two sides of one coin. Among the Olithi women of the South Pacific, Gottlieb says, breastfeeding women joined menstruating women in those huts of seclusion along with the children. And she says that that kind of created a party atmosphere, basically. While menstruation huts can be exclusionary and like a torturous experience for women in some places, there are variations on the theme, and for Olithi women in the South Pacific, where breastfeeding women and menstruating women were kind of excluded from society together, they interpreted that as a very positive thing and kind of threw a party. And in some parts of Ghana in West Africa, young girls sit under umbrellas that are very beautifully crafted, like those are beautifully crafted ceremonial umbrellas that are done, like made for this occasion, when they begin menstruating. And then the family gives her gifts and pays her homages, and she's celebrated like a queen. Like we already talked about this with regard to some areas in India where menstruation is celebrated. And then for the Beng women of the Ivory Coast, Gottlieb found that male-imposed restrictions on menstruating women also come with a positive twist because, quote, an older man, a religious leader in the local religion, told me menstruation is like the flower of a tree. You need the flower before the tree can fruit. That's a very different ideology than the ideology of sin, dirt, and pollution. Unquote. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I already said that the flip side of the menstruation is powerful and terrifying coin is like the menstruation is powerful and terrifying, and that's why we use it for our purposes. And then in some religion, menstruation can even be a powerful tool because, okay, I'm going to have to start again. So the flip side of this idea that menstruation is powerful and terrifying is also that in some traditions, menstruation is powerful and terrifying, and that's why women can use it for their own purposes. So in some religion, menstruation can be a tool. And in some New Orleans voodoo rituals, menstrual blood is used. Wiccans see menstrual blood as powerful and as connected to wisdom. Again, one thing that we must not forget here is the fact that menstruation might be celebrated and giving a special status is usually just the other side of the impure, disgusting coin or a reaction to that, as in the case of Wiccans, right? So even there, menstruations are not a normal, natural part of life, but something other, something special. And even though most of us live very secular lives nowadays, and we don't really follow orthodox religious rules, even though we may be, you know, we may come out of religious traditions. The taboo and the shame and the shaming surrounding menstruation is still very real. We talked about this in the first episode of a series on menstruation. And the idea that menstruation is something disgusting, unclean, or scary seems to be very deeply ingrained in all patriarchal cultures. And to wrap this whole thing up, I would like to quote from a Medium article by Katie Simpson. She says, quote, whether you believe in God or not, these taboos matter. In 2010, there were 1.6 billion Muslims, 1.03 billion Hindus, and 2.17 billion Christians. That's 69% of the total world population. Every day, these taboos impact millions of women. Some of it isn't as drastic as being kicked out into a hut. One study shows that women are seen as less human when they are seen holding a clean menstrual product. But more importantly, taboos shape how we view our own bodies. Another study showed that women from traditions with rules around menstruation were more embarrassed, ashamed, and secluded compared to other women. So should women around the world abandon these rituals? Not so fast. The same study also found that women had a stronger sense of community than those without menstrual rituals. Though these rituals keep women apart, it also gives them a space with each other. Ritual, in my opinion, isn't the issue. The problem is the taboo and shame underlying it. Combining silence and seclusion marks our natural cycle and bodies as alien and different. America, in some ways, is a perfect example of this. As a country with a strong Christian heritage, we no longer have rituals keeping women apart, but the taboos still impact our society. It's inside my embarrassment holding a tampon while walking into a bathroom. It lives in the crazy PMS woman trope. It sits between my teeth as they clench, struggling to deal with cramps while in a meeting. We aren't excluded anymore. We just have to pretend it isn't happening. Religious menstrual taboos are still an obstacle for women, keeping us from being seen as fully human. Yet I'm still hopeful. After all, the variety of religious views on menstruation shows our taboos aren't the only way. Unquote. So, and that goes full circle back to our first episode where we talked about period shaming and period shame. All of what we talked about today, even though it's other contexts from our own, it's like different places, different times, it's religious traditions that are maybe more orthodox or more conservative than what we grew up with. But, you know, the mere fact that we have the same ideas, the same tropes coming up over and over again just shows us that there's something we still are dealing with, you know, and it's the same tropes that also come up in our European traditions, in our North American traditions. You know, it's like it's the same thing that is still happening in pop culture nowadays with as Katie Simpson says, I'll create the crazy PMS woman trope, the shame around having a period, the shame around leakage, you know, the idea that menstruation is something disgusting, all of that has its roots in what we talked about today. And that's why it's important.
And the more that we're quiet about it, the more that we participate, we as a culture, not we just as women, but we as a culture participate in the silencing of narratives about menstruation and silencing about, like, we stop talking about menstruation, the more we kind of reinstantiate these taboos about menstruation. And if we talk about it more, if we have dialogues about it, if we make it less of a secret thing, then we have the ability, hopefully, to kind of flip that script and change that narrative and make it less taboo while still creating these, you know, spaces for menstruating people to be able to talk about their bodies and menstruation.
Which is something a lot of feminists in the 70s did, you know, they kind of created safe spaces. And one of those, one of the goals of it, or agendas of those safe spaces was that women could also talk about, their sexual organs and their menstruation, all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So next time will be the fourth episode in our series, and then we'll talk about how all of the things that we talked about today manifest themselves in pop culture, because we'll talk about menstruation in pop culture, and we'll see whether some of the tropes that we talked about today also figure into our modern day, the modern day images that are created around menstruation.
Yes.
So tune in next time again, and thank you for listening. You can find She Who Persisted on all kinds of podcast apps that you can use to listen to podcasts other than Spotify. I'm still trying to get A She Persisted on there, but for whatever reason, they don't want us. So if you are someone who likes to use Spotify, you can also write them an email and tell them that you want She Persisted on there. That might help us, because my other podcast only got considered by Spotify because listeners wrote them. So
what kind of bullshit is that?
I don't know. I tried to contact them and they did not react. And then listeners wrote them that they want to listen to Große Töchter, which is like my German-speaking feminist podcast, on Spotify. And then they reacted to that and now it's on Spotify. They never reacted to my insisting that I want it on there. So if you are listening to She Persisted on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, then please consider giving us a 5-star rating and a review, because that really helps us. That also helps other people find us.
And but I mean, you hear us say that it helps us, but the way that it helps us is that it increases our numbers. It makes it so that iTunes and all its like secret algorithm knowledge can like push us further up the lists on American, US, North American lists. I mean, we're doing well in Austria, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes it so that, I mean, I don't know how many people like pay attention to reviews when they are choosing a podcast, but the more reviews we have, the more likely people who do pay attention to those reviews are going to say, oh, wow, people love this podcast. So it does help.
Yeah. 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 But mostly I think it's useful for like, getting us like, moving us forward in lists so that people even see us.
Yes.
You know, I think that's the main reason the main reason why podcasters keep asking you to review. It's like, it's very valuable in the podcasting world. And then also, if you want to support us via Patreon, you can do that, patreon.com/shewhopersisted. Again, thank you to Mika, our second patron. You can write us an email, which is currently the best way to get in contact with us, shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. The second best way to get in contact with us is via a Facebook group, which is called Persisters. You can find us on Instagram. We also have a Facebook page. We are on Twitter @shewhopersistedpod. And I think that's it. Oh, we have a homepage, shewhopersisted.com, where you will find the show notes and all the resources and sources we used. So you can do further research yourself if you're interested. And I think now that's it.
I think that's it. And our lesson from today is our periods should not be taboo. And we have the ability to change that.
We do. And one of the most important things that we can do is talk about it.
Yep.
And stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.
Bye.